Okay, great. So we're very happy to have Takeshi Kobayashi, who's visiting us from CETA, but is also here as a joint postdoc here. So you guys should see a lot of him. And anyway, he's going to tell us about density perturbations from the perturbations we visited.
Thank you. So today I would like to talk about some work that I've been doing lately on the curvitone paradigm, which is an interesting idea for generating the primordial density perturbations of our universe. And my talk is mainly based on these papers, which I've written in collaboration with these people. Okay, so let me get started. Okay, so one big question that we would like to answer in cosmology is to tell the origin of all the rich structure we see in our universe today, like the galaxies and galaxy clusters and so on. But nowadays, we think that all these structure in our universe originate from the tiny inhomogeneities in the energy densities that were present in the early universe. So now we can rephrase this question as, then where did those primordial density perturbations come from? I mean, how were they generated? And the curvitone paradigm, the curvitone paradigm, which is the main topic of my talk today, provides a simple explanation for the generation of the primordial density perturbations. Well, basically, the idea is that this mechanism generates the density perturbations from a scalar field, which we often refer to as the curvitone field. And it basically makes use of these superhorizon field fluctuations of this curvitone field that is generated during the inflationary era. And it converts those field fluctuations into the density perturbations of the entire universe. Well, to be more general, nowadays we know quite a lot of early universe models that can give superhorizon and nearly scale invariant field fluctuations to scalar field, among which the most famous is cosmic inflation, but there's also alternatives like Hojave-Lipschitz gravity or the Galileo mechanism and so on. And as long as these early universe models can give these superhorizon field fluctuations to fields, this curvitone mechanism can work. So in this sense, I think you can say that this curvitone mechanism is a rather general mechanism for generating the primordial density perturbations. Well, and there have been extensive work.
So without inflation, you can have, so if you're working on Hojave-Lipschitz gravity, you're saying that there is no inflation and you have resource perturbations.
Yeah, in some versions of the Hojave-Lipschitz gravity, even if you don't have an inflationary era, you can source like superhorizon and almost scalar invariant field fluctuations. And there have been extensive work on this curvitone paradigm. However, most of the works on these curvitons have focused on a rather trivial case, namely the case where this curvitone field possesses a single quadratic energy potential. Well, that case is also nice and simple. However, there are some reasons that we would actually want to go beyond this simplest picture and to study a bit more complicated cases. Well, first of all, when one actually tries to build explicit curvitone models in the framework of microscopic physics, such as supersymmetry or string theory, then often one ends up with a curvitone potential with a rather complicated form. And there's also reasons from the observational point of view, because like the recent CMB data is telling us that the primordial density perturbations had larger amplitude at the larger scales. So in other words, that the primordial density perturbation spectrum was red-tilted. However, in order to realize such red-tilted perturbation spectrum in the curvitone scenario, one has to either require a tachyonic curvitone potential during inflation or require a rather large time variation of the Hubble parameter during inflation, which is the type that can be generated only in specific type of inflation models, like large field ones. Well, I'll talk about the details here, but the point is that unless you rely on specific types of inflationary models, you cannot generate a red-tilted perturbation spectrum from the curvitone scenario. So both from the model-building point of view and also from the observational point of view, it's very important to go beyond the simplest quadratic curvitone picture that have been studied in most of the literature, and to go and study a bit more complicated, more general cases. So that's what I'm going to talk about in the main part of my talk today. So I'll talk about curvitons and their consequences when curvitons have a generic energy potential.
So if you don't have either of these properties, the scenario, if you have a small field, or I guess you don't have a tachyonic curviton, then what happens? Do you get a blue field or just a fairly little field?
Basically a flat or a blue tilted.
You get blue tilted.
Yeah, because the spectral index can be written like it's given by basically the effective potential, this effective mass and this.
As H star is negative, so it's blue. No, H star is
unless, I mean, unless this is like of order 1%, it's very small. Yeah, and this, unless it's tachyonic, this is always positive.
So H star over H squared, you're saying it cannot be very big?
Well, it can only be big in specific types like the large field ones, because basically it's the epsilon. Okay, so in the main part of my talk today, I'm going to talk about the consequences of curvitons possessing general forms of energy potentials. And the result is not just generic, but the interesting thing is that it turns out that once the curviton potential becomes non-quadratic, the curvitons start to behave quite differently. And as a consequence, the resulting denser perturbations also start to have interesting signals, especially when you look into the null Gaussianity. And I should also remark that there have been some works on curvitons studying, curvitons with non-quadratic energy potentials, but most of them relied on heavy numerical computations, which often kind of blurred the underlying physics. And since they relied on numerical computations, they were always limited to individual case studies. But our work is totally analytic, so it enables us to give a comprehensive study on curvitons and to actually know what's actually going on. Okay, so here is the outline of my talk today. So first I'll talk about curvitons. I mean, I'll give general discussions on the curvitons when they have generic energy potentials. And as examples, I'll talk about curvitons which have potentials flatter compared to the familiar quadratic potential. And then I'll talk about curvitons having potentials that are steeper compared to the quadratic ones. And at the final part of my talk, if time allows, I would like to present an explicit realization of the curviton in the framework of string theory. Well, this final part is something that I've worked on a few years ago. So it's not a new work, but I think it would help grasp some ideas on how curvitons can actually be embedded in the framework of microscopic physics. Okay, so I would like to start by giving a general discussion on curvitons. So first I'll give a brief review on the curviton scenario, on the familiar case where the curviton has a quadratic energy potential. And even though I said that this curviton mechanism can work with non-inflationary scenarios, today I will focus on the case where inflation has happened, so that the field fluctuations were sourced during inflation. Okay, then, basically a curviton, it's a light scalar field whose energy density is negligibly tiny during the inflationary era. So here I'm showing the energy density and how it redshifts as the universe expands. So the horizontal axis is the log of the scale factor, and the vertical is the energy densities of the inflaton sector and of the curviton. So during inflation, the energy density of the inflaton sector is almost constant, and after inflation, at some point, this inflaton should decay into radiation at the time of reheating. So after that, the energy density of the inflaton decays a redshift proportionally to 1 over the scale factor to the power of 4. On the other hand, for curvitons, well, we're assuming this curviton field to be light. So initially, it's stuck at some point along its energy potential due to the Hubble friction. So during inflation, the energy density of the curviton is nearly constant. However, after inflation ends, as the Hubble parameter becomes lower, the Hubble friction becomes weaker. So at some point, the curviton starts to oscillate about its local minimum. and an oscillating scalar field acts like non-relativistic matter. So after the onset of the curvitron oscillation, the energy density of the curvitron redshifts proportionally to 1 over the volume. So the point is that even if the curvitron energy density is initially negligibly tiny, after inflation, if you wait long enough, its energy density fraction increases and comes closer and closer to dominating the universe until the curvitron decays into radiation. And another important thing is that since this curvitron field is light, it obtains superhorizon field fluctuations of the Hubble parameter during inflation. So it means that among different patches of the universe, the curvitron field has slightly different field values. So as a consequence, the curvitron energy density is also slightly inhomogeneous.
So the perturbations happen during inflation, not during the oscillation.
Right, during inflation. But the point is that since the curvitron energy density is initially negligibly tiny, its density perturbations is even more negligible. However, after inflation, the curvitron comes closer and closer to dominating the universe. So the energy density fluctuations of the curvitron sector, it converts into the energy density fluctuations of the entire universe. So that's how the curvitron mechanism produces the density perturbations of our universe. So this is a basic picture with the quadratic curvitrons that have been studied in many cases. So now let's go and look at curvitrons with arbitrary potentials. So in this case, the story becomes a bit different because for curvitrons with non-quadratic energy potentials, the time when the curvitron starts its oscillation also becomes inhomogeneous. Because, well, roughly speaking, the time when the curvitron starts its oscillation is determined by the time when the Hubble parameter of the universe becomes comparable to the effective mass of the curvitron. However, for non-quadratic potentials, the effective mass, so I mean the second derivative of the potential, is no longer a constant. Therefore, if the curvitron field value is slightly different, it means that the time when the curvitron starts its oscillation also becomes different. So this sources additional contributions to the resulting density perturbations, because patches of the universe where the curvitron starts its oscillation at earlier times end up having a smaller energy density for the curvitrons. So for the general case, I mean for curvitrons with non-quadratic potentials, there's additional contributions to the density perturbations due to this inhomogeneous onset of the curvitron oscillations. So we can see this explicitly when we do some calculations. So here I'm showing the power spectrum amplitude of the resulting curvature perturbations from a curvitron. Well, I'm not going to talk about the details of this calculation, but basically I'm just doing a delta n formalism calculation following the evolution of this curvitron field. So the result can be written in terms of the curvitron potential, B, with the curvitron field value at the time when the CMB scale exits the horizon, and also at the time when the curvitron starts the oscillation. And this tiny r is the curvitron energy fraction upon its decay. And well, this result looks a bit complicated, but what I want to say here is that these terms shown in blue, well, I've defined this x like this, but these are the effects due to the non-uniform onset of the curvitron oscillation. And one can clearly see that for a quadratic curvitron potential, this part disappears. So one can clearly see that only for non-quadratic curvitron potentials, these effects due to the non-uniform onset of oscillations show up and modify the results or the power spectrum of the curvature perturbations.
Isn't sigma sitting at zero? Why is, what is the value of sigma oscillation?
Oh, so at some point, so the curvitron is somewhere when the CMB scale exits the horizon, and after inflation, it starts to roll slightly, and then it starts to oscillate. So that sigma os is like the value right before the curve down starts the oscillation.
So it's not the starting from zero, it's the starting from finite.
No.
Is that the standard thing? You don't have to start from some finite sigma star?
Well, I mean, if the original place was like at the minimum, the resulting perturbations will be totally non-Gaussian. Because this should be larger than the Hubble parameter. I mean, it should have a well-defined classical value, bigger than the quantum fluctuations during inflation, because otherwise the results would be totally non-Gaussian. Okay, so like basically it's like the initial amplitude of the oscillation, the sigma off. Okay, so from the power spectrum, you can also calculate the spectral index, so the tilt of the perturbation spectrum, which is, I talked about this briefly in the introduction, but basically the spectral tilt is given by the effective mass, so the second derivative of the curvilinear potential, and also the time derivative of the Hubble parameter during inflation. And the latest results from CMB is telling us that the spectral index was negative, so it was red-tilted almost at this 3-sigma level. In order to realize values like this, then one should either have this part to be negative, so that the curvilinear potential should be tachyonic, or this part should be quite large, of order like 1%, which can only be realized by like large field inflation models. So in other words, unless you rely on those large field models, the simplest quadratic curvilinear picture cannot generate a red-tilted perturbation spectrum. So this is one of the motivations that led us to study curvilineas with non-quadratic energy potentials. So one can carry out similar calculations for the non-Gaussianity parameter as well, I mean for the bispectrum of the curvature perturbations, and this is a result, and it just looks messy, but what I want to say here is that this result is totally different from the case for the familiar quadratic curvitons. Because for the quadratic curviton case, the non-Gaussianity parameter is just defined by the curviton energy fraction upon its decay. And for that case, a large FNL was produced only when this R was much smaller than 1. So only if the curviton decayed before it dominated, only when the curviton decayed before dominating the universe. However, for the general case, one can see that the story is totally different.
In this case, which means that the major source of perturbations is the inflaton, right? If you
no.
Think that from the curvature side?
No. In which case?
Well, that you just showed. So, so in the usual quadratic curviton, so what happens? So if F naught is big, it means that the curviton decay when was subdominant?
Yeah.
And then does that mean that the dominant source of perturbation is the inflaton?
Oh, no, it doesn't have to dominate the universe to produce the linear perturbations. I mean, it will be.
R is the initial ratio of their energy
density? Oh, it's the ratio when the curviton decays. But still, I mean, if it doesn't dominate, its linear perturbations, the amplitude will be. There will be some sort of suppression factor. I mean, it will be suppressed by this R, but still it can produce the linear perturbations.
So it can still be the major source.
Exactly. Well, of course, it's depending on how much the inflaton generates, but it can. So for the general case, one can clearly see that that large non-Gaussianity with either sign can be generated no matter the curviton dominates or subdominates the universe upon its decay. So so far I have been giving a general discussion on curvitons, but the results is a bit complicated. It doesn't really tell you what sort of things you can expect. So let's go into some examples. So as a first example, I'll talk about the case where the curviton potential is flatter compared to the familiar quadratic case. And actually, in this case, when the curviton potential is flat, it will lead to the effects due to the non-uniform onset of the curviton oscillation becomes very important. Because if the potential is flat, it means that if the curviton field value is slightly different, Even if the field difference is little, the time when the curvaton starts the oscillation can become very different. So these effects due to the non-uniform onset of the oscillation becomes important. And as a consequence, it will lead to a strong enhancement of the resulting density perturbations, both for the linear perturbations and also for the nonlinear perturbations. So we will see this through a simple toy model, where the curvaton is realized as a pseudonormal Goldstone boson of an approximate U-1 symmetry, with the curvaton potential taking this sort of cosine type form. Well, this is just a toy model, but it's a toy model with nice features in the sense that, well, first of all, one can invoke this kind of approximate symmetries to suppress a curvaton mass during inflation. And also, since it's a pseudonormal Goldstone boson of a periodic symmetry, the resulting curvaton potential, it will necessarily have both local minima and maxima. And if the curvaton field value during inflation was close to the local maxima, it means that the second derivative of the potential is negative. So that in this case, the resulting perturbations spectrum can be red tilted, as is indicated by observations.
So in potentials like this that open up, there's an instability for the condensate to fragment.
Uh-huh.
And so do you have to arrange it so that you have this right sign second derivative in the place where the perturbations are produced, but then the second derivative changes fast enough so that your condensate doesn't fragment? Or how do you prevent that from...
Well, in this kind of simple cosine type potential, even if they're around this point during inflation, after it starts the oscillation, it soon damps to like the region where it's well approximated by the quadratic. So I don't think you have to worry about the formations of those oscillons. But if the potential like extended with to a bigger range with that flat region, and if the curvaton expands the oscillation along that flat region for a long time, then I think you'll have to worry about the formation of oscillons. But in this case, for the reason I just said, we don't worry about that.
But it doesn't have to be oscillons. I mean, you can show even at the linear level that there's an instability that's exponential that operates on microscopic timescales.
Uh-huh. So do you think it will be like dangerous soon, quickly, or?
I don't know. It's a question of numbers, I guess. I was just wondering if that was a constraint that you...
Yeah, well, actually, so for the reason I said, we didn't worry about that because it oscillates mostly in the quadratic region, but maybe it could, yeah.
So Matt, you're saying if the inflaton-induced fluctuation, I mean, if the fluctuation is just knocked over the top of the dome into the neighboring, in some region of the space, into the neighboring well?
No, just if I have an oscillating scalar field, then there's a linear instability depending on the shape of the potential. The condition is that the potential opens up as you go further away, which is exactly the condition that you need to get this red tilted spectrum. So in such potentials, there is an exponentially growing instability for the condensate fragment. And it's set by the numbers in the potential and not the Hubble scale. So it's fast compared to the Hubble time. But it's a question of numbers. I don't know what's in the exponent. Could be
slow enough.
Okay.
I guess this is kind of related, I think. So usually when people think about scalar field oscillating in its minimum, you can calculate perturbative decay, right? But it's always wrong. It's very smart. There's not perturbative decay of this so-called preheating scenario, where you have basic instabilities at the air. So whenever you have fields oscillating in the bottom of the potential, it's not really perturbative decay, right?
That depends on how it's coupled to the decay product.
So, but there's self-coupling, right?
Uh-huh.
So the self-coupling is there, and I think it's the same thing as what Matt was talking about, that the self-coupling is always much more important than that perturbative coupling.
I wouldn't think that it would be always important that the non-perturbative decays would be. I think it's like a special region in the parameter window where the non-contingent can be
transported. There has been this like, large body of literature I'm repeating, left half of
the the oscillation, I think the amplitude is very big.
Which is what happens here, right?
Yeah, but like amplitude, as Ido said, the amplitude should be quite large for pure heating to work.
But you start with a big amplitude. I mean, it is damped, but I think the instability works on shorter time, on parallel times.
Well, it depends on how large this field range itself is, right?
Well, okay, there's something to talk about.
Mm,
but
yeah.
There is all this literature on. I mean, I think in the old days, people used to calculate these decay rates, but they have been always too small.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was this period in the 90s where people figured out that this preheating scenario is much more efficient than this decay rate.
Yeah, maybe it may be interesting to consider this. The non-perturbative stuff, seriously. Well, okay, but my talk today, I'm not going to talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
But okay, so... So let's continue my talk on this toy model. So for this case, I'll simply set the curvaton decay rate as perturbative, and that its coupling with the curvaton with its decay product is, I'll just simply assume that it's suppressed by the symmetry breaking scale F, and so the decay rate like this. Okay, and so for this toy model, here I'm fixing all the parameters of the model, except for the initial curvaton field value, so the curvaton field value during compression. And in terms of that field value, I'm plotting the power spectrum amplitude and also the non-Gaussianity parameter. And for comparison, I'm also showing the results as from the familiar quadratic case as red dashed lines. And then, one can clearly see that if the initial field value was close to the local minimum, then the potential is well approximated by a quadratic. So the results for this non-Goldstone curvaton and the quadratic curvaton is more or less the same. However, as the initial field value approaches the hilltop, the results become very different. And this is exactly due to the effects from the non-uniform onset of the oscillations becomes, because if you approach the hilltop, the potential becomes flatter, and then these non-uniform onset of the oscillations become very important. And when you go even closer to the hilltop, actually, the linear perturbation amplitude blows up because know that this is a log scale, so it's blowing up. On the other hand, the FNL parameter only increases mildly. Oh, and I forgot to say that, but for this, I'm focusing on the case where the curvaton dominates the universe before it decays. And recall that for quadratic curvatons, a dominant curvaton, it cannot produce a large non-Gaussianity, but for this NG curvaton, for these hilltop types, even if it dominates the universe before it decays, it can produce a rather large FNL. Okay, so, I'm just repeating, but as the initial field value approaches the hilltop, the linear perturbations are strongly enhanced and accompanied by a mild increase of the non-Gaussianity parameter. So we can see this from a different point of view, by looking at the actual parameter window that allows this model to work. So for this toy model, we basically have five free parameters, basically the symmetry breaking scale F and the height of the potential lambda and the inflationary scale and the reheating temperature, I mean, the time when the inflaton decays, and also the initial curvaton field value during inflation. And among these five free parameters, I will fix two by fixing the linear perturbation amplitude to take the Kolbe normalization value, and also from fixing the spectral index to be about 0.96, which is a central value from the CMB constraints. And then we are left with three parameters. So if we fix the inflaton initial field value to somewhere in the intermediate range, then this tiny part is the allowed window in terms of the two-dimensional plane of the inflationary scale and the reheating temperature. Well, this gray part is just ruled out because reheating should happen after inflation. So one can see that for this intermediate case, the allowed window is only restricted to a very high inflation and reheating scales. Well, because we're fixing the spectral index to be about 0.96, so that we're assuming we're fixing the curvaton effective mass to be about 10% of the Hubble parameter during inflation. So that means that the curvaton, soon after inflation ends, the curvaton starts its oscillation. But in order for the curvaton to source a large perturbation amplitude, I mean large as the Kolbe normalization value, then the curvaton has to come close to somewhat dominating the inverse. So you have to wait a very, very long time for this oscillating curvaton to dominate the inverse. So that's why the Ladd window is restricted to a very high scale. However, if the curvaton field value is set closer to the hilltop, then the Ladd window broadened and come to lower scales, because if you approach the hilltop, the time when the curvaton starts its oscillation is delayed toward later times. And also, as I said, due to the effects from the inhomogeneous start of the oscillations, the resulting density perturbations are enhanced. So as a consequence, the whole parameter window comes to lower scales with known Gaussianity of somewhere like 10.
So I'm not sure I understand. How does the fact that the curvaton is higher affect the energy scale of inflation?
Oh yeah, so the basic thing is that if it's not in the hilltop region, you have to wait a long time for this curvaton to, you want to have the curvaton to come close to dominating the universe in order to produce a substantially large linear perturbation amplitude. And in this case, but the curvaton starts to oscillate soon. So you have to wait a very, very long time for the curvaton to actually dominate the universe. So that's why you want everything to start at early times, so that you have enough time for the curvaton to dominate the universe. However, if you approach the hilltop, the time when the curvaton starts its oscillation is delayed because the potential is flatter. So even if you don't wait that long, the curvaton can easily dominate the universe. And also, the resulting density perturbations are enhanced. So there's like those double effects that allow a lower scales to work.
You can't have this delay, this hilt of the curvaton with a high scale inflation, right? Everything moves down.
Because
that's your second graph.
Because if you have like a hilltop with too high inflation scales, I think it will produce too large perturbation amplitude. And if you go even closer to the hilltop, the Ladd window broadens and it comes even to lower scales with F and L of slightly bigger. But if you go too close to the hilltop, then the requirement that, you want the curvaton to decay at latest before the Big Bang nucleosynthesis, so that requirement kicks in and it deletes the parameter window at all, completely. So the point is that for this toy model, as one approaches the hilltop, the Ladd window is broadened significantly, accompanied by pretty large non-Gaussianity, lying in the range of a few tens. So through this toy model, we have seen that curvaton potentials that are flatter compared to a quadratic leads to a strong enhancement of the linear and nonlinear perturbations. Okay, so as a second example, now we're going to consider the case where the curvaton potential steepens compared to a quadratic one. Well, in this case, the effective mass squared of the potential is always positive, so you have to rely on like large field inflation models to generate a red tilted perturbation spectrum. However, in this case, it has some phenomenologically interesting consequences in the sense that these steep curvaton potentials can lead to a strong scale dependence of the resulting known Gaussianity, even if the linear perturbations are almost scale invariant. So from the phenomenological point of view, I will also like to briefly introduce this case. But before going into the curvaton part, let me talk about how I'm going to parameterize the running of the known Gaussianity. So I'm sure that there's a lot of ways you can parameterize the scale dependence of the non-Gaussianity parameter. But here I'm going to parameterize it by defining like a spectral index for the FNL parameter, like this, this n FNL. And for the curvaton case, this n FNL is determined by the third derivative of the curvaton potential. And the thing is that there's some forecast that using the Planck satellite, if the product of these n FNL and FNL is larger than about 5, then the data from the Planck satellite will be able to detect the running of the non-gas additive. And this is just the results from CMB. So if you combine it with large-scale structures, I think the detection limit will be much better. OK, so keeping this in mind, let's go back to the curvaton, sorry. So as a simple model of curvaton potentials that steepen compared to a quadratic one, we'll consider these curvatons with self-interaction terms whose power is larger than 2, okay, so that the potential steepens up. Okay, so here again, I'm fixing all the parameters except for the initial curvaton field value. And in terms of the curvaton field value, I'm plotting the perturbation amplitude of the power spectrum. And here I'm showing the curvaton energy fraction upon its decay. So again, if the initial field value is close to the local minimum, then the results are more or less the same with the quadratic curvatons. And basically, it's an increasing function in terms of the field value, because if you start the curvaton from larger field values, the energy fraction upon its decay increases, so the resulting perturbation amplitude also increases. However, if you go into the large field range where the curvaton potential is steep, then the resulting perturbation amplitude, you can see that it's highly suppressed compared to the quadratic case. And this is because if the curvaton field starts from the steep part, then the potential forces this curvaton field to roll down. And while it's rolling down, the initial difference in the field value is diminished. So as a consequence, the resulting density perturbations are strongly suppressed. And as a consequence, in this intermediate region, there's something like a peak in the perturbation amplitude. And recall that in the language of the delta n formalism, the linear perturbations is basically given by the first derivative of the E folding number in terms of the field value. So this having a local maximum means that the second derivative of the E folding number disappears there. So it means that the non-Gaussianity parameter disappears at this point. And since the n FNL parameter is defined as a derivative of the log of FNL, FNL vanishing means that the n FNL blows up. Well, of course, if the FNL is exactly 0, there's no way that we can detect non-Gaussianity at all. But in the vicinity of this part, there's a region that where the non-Gaussianity and also the n FNL can both be big. So you can see this by looking at the two-dimensional plane of the n FNL and FNL. And one can see that for these kind of self-interacting curvatons with steep potentials, the resulting non-Gaussianity can lie outside of this Planck detection limit, which is denoted by the black dashed line. So that it actually shows that these steep potentials can source a largely strongly scale-dependent FNL. Okay, so basically that's basically about the general discussion on the curvaton. So let me just give a short summary on that part. So we have looked into curvatons possessing general energy potentials. And it turns out that it exhibited new behaviors, like flat potentials led to a strong enhancement of the density perturbations. And on the other hand, steep potentials could lead to a strongly scale-dependent non-Gaussianity. OK, so in my final part, I would like to present an explicit curvaton model in the framework of type 2B string theory, where the extra 6 dimensions are compactified to a warped throughout regions, a region possessing some approximate isometries. And in this case, I will show that the moving degrees of freedom of a D-brain in this warped throughout region can actually play the role of curvatons. And in this model, The geometric features of this compactified throat plays an important role for realizing the curvaton. So I'll start by giving a by explaining the geometric features that I'm going to consider in this model. So to make the discussion a bit more concrete, for this smart throat region, I'll consider like a deformed conifold type throat, which is the case that is often that is used in many compactification scenarios. So basically, it's warped in direction, and this deformed conifold, it's like a six-dimensional cone. And the five-dimensional base space is locally an S3 times an S2, and we're considering a deformed conifold. So as one approaches the throat tip, this S2 shrinks to zero size, while this S3 remains finite. So even at the throat tip, due to this S3, there's isometries along the angular directions. And for our curvaton model, we're going to assume that there's an anti-D3 brain sitting at the throat tip, and we're going to consider this anti-D3 brain as a toy model for a standard model brain. So we're going to assume that we're living on this anti-D3 sitting at this throat tip of a deformed conifold. Then you may expect that the standard model brain can move freely along the angular directions due to this isometry of this S3. But if you look closer, it's a bit more complicated because there's many effects that actually break this angular isometries. Like, for example, this conifold, it cannot extend forever. It has to be glued to a compactified bulk, which does not necessarily possess the same kind of isometries. So there's always these bulk effects that break the angular isometries. And moreover, there may be like non-perturbative effects that one may use for stabilizing the moduli. Like, for example, one may imagine like D7 brains wrapping a certain force cycle, and those can have interactions with this anti-D3 brain and give potential along the angular directions. But the thing is that all these effects that give potential along the angular directions, they become weaker as you approach the throat tip because of the warping of the throat. So as a consequence, the anti-D3 brain sitting at the throat tip ends up feeling a very weak potential along the angular directions. So in other words, the angular degrees of freedom of this standard model brain ends up having a very small mass. And this degree of freedom, the angular degree of freedom, is what is going to play the role of the curvaton in this model. So the basic picture is that this standard model brain, it starts to oscillate along the angular direction after inflation ends. And while it's oscillating, it generates the density perturbations of our universe. And also, while it's as it oscillates, it excites the other open string modes on the D-brain. So in other words, the moving degrees of freedom of this D-brain, which plays a role of the curvaton, decays into the standard model particles. And the reason why we considered anti-D3 brain as a toy model of the standard model brain, except for D3 brains, is that because anti-D3 brain feels more of these isometry breaking effects than a D3 brain. And having a lot of these isometry breaking effects play an important role. So that's why we consider it an anti-D3. So basically, the action for this curvaton is the action that an anti-D3 feels in this warped throat geometry. So basically, the action comes from the DBI action and the Chern-Simons term. And in the DBI action, we've explicitly shown here I'm showing the world volume fermions, because those are what the curvaton decay into first. So after some field redefinition, we are left with the curvaton field and the world volume fermions and their couplings and the curvaton mass. And well, basically, the point here is that all these coupling and the potential comes from the effects that break the angular isometries, like the bulk effects and the non-perturbative effects. And both of these effects are suppressed by some powers of the warp factor at the throat tip, which I've denoted by H0. And how much these effects are suppressed, I have parameterized those by this delta and lambda. The explicit values of this delta and lambda depends on the details of the compactification scenario. So here I'm showing the parameter window that actually allows this model to work. For simplicity, I've fixed parameters like the string scale, the string coupling, the Wharf factor, and the background flux number. Then we are left with the delta and lambda, which were the parameters.
So is this quadratic? I guess it looks quadratic in sigma.
I was going to talk about that soon, but yeah, actually, it's not just a quadratic potential. But when we did this work, we were just focusing on the quadratic case, so the case where the d-brains were located close to the minimum. So these parameters are the parameters that show how much these isometry break-in effects are suppressed in terms of the Wharf factor. So basically, if these parameters are large, it means that these effects are suppressed by higher powers of the Wharf factor, which means that their effects become weaker. So if you go into the right or upper directions, it means that these isometry break-in effects are weaker. But if you go too much in that direction, the decay rate of the curviton gets suppressed too much. But you want the curviton to decay at latest before the Big Bang nucleosynthesis, so that gives this orange line restriction. On the other hand, if the curviton decays too early, it produces too large non-Gaussianity, so that gives this red line this restriction. And also, the curviton mass should be lighter than the Hubble primary ring inflation, which gives this blue line. So this yellow region is the region that actually allows this parameter, this model to work. And like, for example, if this deformed conifold is a Klebanov-Stressler throat, a solution of this Klebanov-Stressler solution, and for the non-perturbative effects, if we consider a Cooperstein embedding of the D7 brain, then the parameter drops here in the workable region. But as Nayesh pointed out, when we were studying this model a few years ago, we have considered on the quadratic case. So the case where the curviton D brain is located close to the local minimum of the potential during inflation. But, well, it's basically an S3 along the angular directions, so the potential is periodic. And for sure, there's also these non-quadratic regions. And so I guess the story would become different. But we haven't done the analysis for that. So let me just end by saying that non-quadratic curvitons in the warp throats may further broaden the parameter window. So that's about it. So I'd like to wrap up. So today I've talked about curvitons possessing generic energy potentials. And it turned out that curvitons actually have rich phenomenology. Like, for example, like flat potentials can lead to a strong enhancement of the resulting density perturbations, while steepened potentials can source a strong scale dependence to the non-Gaussianity. And as an explicit model, I presented a curviton model where D-brains moving in the Wharf throat regions can play the role of curvitons. And for one direction of future work, I would like to apply this rather generic discussion on the curviton to microscopic cases. Okay, so that's quite it. Thank you.
Questions? I've got one. So you didn't mention running of the spectral index, but would that be a meaningful constraint on these hilltop type models? Because I would expect the running to be quite large.
Exactly. Let me see. So basically, the running of the non-Gaussianity. The running of the non-Gaussianity and the running of the spectral index are both determined by the third derivative of the curviton potential. So if the running of the non-Gaussianity becomes large, the running of the spectral index also becomes large. But like those hilltop models, both are small. But on the other hand, for those steep potentials, in general, if the running of the non-Gaussianity becomes large, the running of the spectral index also becomes large. But for hilltop models, both are small. And for steep cases, that's a kind of a rare example where the running of the spectral index is small, but the running of the non-Gaussian entity becomes large.
So I have a question regarding quadratic curvatons. So if the curvaton initially sits in the minimum and you just, you know, has quantum fluctuations, then there's no effect at all. I mean, how far, is there some minimal distance that you have to be away from the minimum?
Well,
even for a quadratic curve?
Naively, it has to be displaced larger than the Hubble parameter during inflation, because otherwise there's no good classical picture, and the result will be totally non-Gaussian. So basically, if the displacement is larger than the Hubble parameter during inflation, it should work. I mean, there's a window.
So that's
that,
the minimal.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that the constraint on that analogy is how far you can be, right?
Yeah.
But then, so doesn't that mean, so let's say, so.
Oh, I mean, because, you know, like, so if it's simply a quadratic, the potential is like, it's like this.
Okay.
So if you just expand it, it will be something like. Well, I dropped the numerics, but. I dropped the coefficients, but it would be something like this. And this is of order Hubble, right? But so if, and this is like the field value during inflation. So if this is larger than this, then the second expansion becomes comparable to this square, and the result becomes nonlinear. So this part has to dominate if you wanted a linear result.
But then don't you expect them in any particle theory to have such scalar fields sitting in the minimum and having quantum fluctuations? Unless they're very heavy, but then it means that particle fields during inflation have to be very heavy, otherwise you get a huge non-Gaussian system.
Oh, yeah.
But I mean, assuming that they're weakly coupled enough.
Oh, so like you imagine like some like axionic fields with very light mass sitting close to the minimum.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it depends. It depends on how they are coupled to the subtle model particles. But if they're not, they would just produce like isocurvature fluctuations, which are very non-Gaussian. So yeah, they have a chance of producing very non-Gaussian isocurvature fluctuations, if you don't be careful.
So does it give you strong bounds on the existence of such?
I think, yeah, I think there is some works on like a giving restrictions on axions from how large, from restricting the isocurvature fluctuations. At least for the linear isocurvature fluctuations, there are discussions on that. For the non-Gaussian isocurvature fluctuations, I'm not sure.
Questions? Okay, let's take a question.